Session number 13522.
Ryan Reel 6.
This other friend of mine, who was a Marine, the same age as me, he was called Jimmy Aldridge. And the other lad, oh lad, we were all lads, his name was Stan Hicks. And he and I had actually joined the Royal Marines together on the same day. And we both came from London. Now, the five of them were in this landing craft and it disappeared in the wind and rain of this storm in the darkness. And there was nothing we could literally do to do any more help. And so the next morning when it got light, unfortunately the storm started to abate and the waters calmed down. In the meantime, a signal had been sent off to the commanding officer who was on the main island of Yeovil. Colonel Drysdale came over and, having been informed of the situation, he then asked for volunteers to stand by to go and try and rescue them if they were spotted. And it goes without saying that every one of us wanted to be part of the team to rescue our mates. For 2 days, aircraft from aircraft carriers of the American Navy searched the shorelines from the air looking for signs of the boat or the chaps and wreckage or whatever, and they couldn't sight anything. They had a report back that some men had been sighted on one of the coves, of the many little rocky coves, etc., on the mainland, but it wasn't confirmed. And we never heard any more until at Christmas 1951, a message was broadcast from the Chinese People's Republican Army, or the Chinese Peace Army, as I believe they were called, the People's Peace. And amongst the prisoners of war of the Royal Marines were listed five of the chaps who'd been disappeared off the island that night. So at least we knew they had reached Wonsan and had been taken prisoner, which at least was some news, if nothing at all. The follow-up to that story, if I can just intrude into it a little moment, was 3 years later, back in England, my friend Stan Hicks was repatriated, and he then told me the story of what happened to him and the remainder of that small group. They were taken prisoner. What had happened, they hid up in this little cove. All they had on was their swimming costumes. They had some weapons with them, which we carried at all times anyway, and they were preparing to defend themselves should they be attacked. But unfortunately, when it got light after the second day, they were surrounded completely by one quite large group of Chinese army, and they were taken prisoner. There was nothing they could do except to surrender. And so they were marched through the streets of Wonsan. They weren't treated exactly kindly. They were given a sack of rice apiece to carry. And when the Sergeant Major, QMS Day, complained that this was against the Geneva Convention for treatment of prisoners of war, he was politely, if I can say politely, informed that the sack of rice which each man had to carry on his back was his food. It was not a punishment, it was his food. That was the answer they were given. And so they had to carry that sack of rice as they marched northwards towards Manchuria and the prisoner of war camp. An instance to give you a little idea of how they suffered is when Stan was telling me the story, he said after the second day, each section of this march, a group of guards would take them on this part of the way, and then another group of guards would take over as they moved further and further north. There was no towns where you could be put in a prison. They were just, when it got dark, they were just taken to the nearest civilian hut and put in there and tied up and given some food by whoever happened to be living in that little hut. The food they were given is what now comes into a point which you will get some idea of how they had to fend. Stan said he looked to see how big the woman was in the hut when they were put there for the night. Strange thought. But you can understand it when he said if it was a big woman, they felt quite happy. And the reason was they were given rice balls to eat, and a big woman would have big hands and they'd get a bigger rice ball. And if it was a small woman, they'd just get a tiny little rice ball. And that was their food until the next day. They marched for approximately 10 days until they were put into a prisoner of war camp. The best thing I can say here is that this story should come from a prisoner of war himself, because only someone who's been in a prisoner of war camp can really tell you. But that is an indication of the treatment of the prisoners of war in the Korean War. Stan was awarded an Admiralty commendation by the Queen when he got back to England. He attempted to escape three times, and if ever you hear his story, if he will tell you it, which is very, very shy to tell, you will understand the sufferings of the prisoners of war in North Korea. In the meantime, back on the islands, we carried on as normal. We lost two men a short while later. One was a sergeant, very well loved, another a young officer, and we buried them on the large island of Yeouido, and we carried on much the same, living on the islands and endeavouring to keep our humour up in various ways. And I think really, and once again, the majority of us being young men, it's strange how you can adapt yourself to various conditions of lifestyles whilst in the service and not grumble about it. You hear people say, you know, they're always grumbling, but a serviceman who's done quite a few years in the service, I think, is entitled to grumble now and again, but it is amazing the conditions which they will put up with and come out smiling. My other thoughts on the island, I would love to go back there after all these years. It's probably a little holiday island now, and in North Korea, where you're not allowed to go, I'd love to stand there. But I've got some very, very precious thoughts of that island, and precious to myself, and I think you understand what I mean. We left the islands and went back to Japan in late November 1951. And this time we went to a place called Sasebo, which is in the south of Japan, and mainly occupied by American naval forces. Sasebo is a vast harbour which was used by the Japanese in World War II as a massive great naval harbour. We were billeted in an old seaplane depot about 12 miles outside of Sasebo in tents. Once again, there was not really anywhere where they seemed to be able to put our small group of 4-1 commando. We were independent, and I think they said, well, if they're independent, let them get on with it. But nevertheless, we settled down quite well into a tented camp in this place outside, about 12 miles outside of Sasebo. Now, a little bit more about the situation in Japan. The Americans were still occupying Japan, as were a lot of the British Commonwealth forces. And at the same time, the Japanese were trying to get their rights and independence back, whatever. And the political situation was that the Japanese wanted the Americans and all other forces to leave Japan. Now the war was all over. And whilst this was going on, thousands of servicemen were in different parts of Japan. And in Sasebo, being a massive great naval port, most of the American Navy and all its ships, if they were now operating in Korean waters, were in Sasebo, and they were all on shore leave. It's a sight in Sasebo which would never ever be repeated. If you can imagine thousands of sailors in their uniform, their tropical whites, and thousands of Japanese who are trying to entice them into beer halls, beer bars, places of ill repute, and taxi dances. There's beggars on the streets. There's the black marketeers trying to buy stuff of them. There's trinkets being sold. There's fantastic antiques, which if you've got a bit of money, you can pick up, because the Japanese were selling everything they could just to exist. Add this all together, and you've got quite a massive, seething mass of humanity. Enter 41 Independent Commando on shore leave, after having been up on the islands in Wonsan Harbour for 4 months. We naturally wanted a little bit of excitement. And unfortunately, this is whereby people clash, and in the beer halls and beer bars, the fights that used to go on was better than any John Wayne movie you've ever seen. And I can recollect on one particular occasion, when we were in Yokosuka, we called it the Battle of the Yokosuka Beer Hall. This was a three-storied building, a bar and a dance floor on each floor, filled up with countless servicemen, mainly American Navy, American Marines, and a few, unfortunate, American Army. And the American forces, for some reason, the Navy disliked the Marines disliked the Navy, but the Navy and the Marines hate the Army. So if ever there was a bit of trouble, a poor unfortunate chap in the American Army would always come out the worst. Add on to this, 41 Independent Commando allowed to go into Yokosuka for a few beers the night before doing a commando raid. Well, the natural thing is drink up while you may. And gradually, you've got your favourite little bar where you go for a drink, but you don't want to cause any bother there. So you leave that one, and gradually you all end up at one big bar, which happened to be the Yokosuka Beer Hall. And enter about 100 American chaps in American Navy uniform, another 100 in American Marine uniform, 100 Royal Marines, and you'll get in the likelihood of a bit of trouble. And out of nowhere, a bottle goes flying through the air and it hits a chap in the Royal American Navy, and within seconds there's a heaving mass of fighting going on. On this particular night, 15 MPs were injured, American Shore Patrol MPs. Members of 41 Independent Commando marched along the road singing our favourite song, which is We're a Shower of Bastards. And the following day, the unit was paraded. Colonel Drysdale came and inspected us, and he says, there are 15 American MPs in hospital. That's where they'd all ended up. I can see several broken arms with people with their arms in sling, countless black eyes. I've mustered you. There is not one person missing. I've only one thing to say to you lot. Well done. And that really was Colonel Drysdale. He had a man who you could follow, and he was as fierce as anything, but he could see when it was time to let you relax. Well, that's a little instance of life ashore in Japan, and I hope I've given you a bit of instance of what happened in 4-1 Commando in Korea. In December of 1951, we were shipped home to England. What had happened is that we had carried out so many commando raids that when we were doing the final few raids off the islands of Wonsan, each time we landed, the enemy was waiting literally on the beach and would open up with everything they had of machine gun, mortars, whatever, to just wipe us out. And we try another location a couple of nights later, and once again there was enemy waiting there. This proved to us that we had caused vast numbers of the Chinese army, as well as the North Korean army, to pull back from the front line to guard the coast against our attacks. And it is my lonely opinion, as a Royal Marine, and nothing but, I never got to the rank of general, but it is my honest opinion that, small though our unit was, we did a great deal to shorten that terrible war and possibly to save many, many of our fellow servicemen who were having to rough it out, actually laying in the slit trenches and the bunkers in Korea. Perhaps we saved them from more and more of the Chinese army attacking them, because it was obvious to us that we had succeeded completely in our role of carrying out commando raids. We disrupted their supply lines. We destroyed their supply lines. There's even railway lines to this day which have not yet been repaired in North Korea. I've seen film of it. And so we were successful in our task, and we're very proud of what happened. One of the proudest things that happened to every one of us in 41 Independent Commando was after the withdrawal from the Chosin Reservoir. Because of that action, whereby having been surrounded by over 120,000 Chinese, as well as other North Korean, and been under attack constantly, and come out of that trap having fought our way out, the President of the United States conferred on 41 Independent Commando the Presidential Unit Citation for gallantry. And we men of 41 Independent Commando have that battle streamer on the regimental colours of 41 Commando, and those colours to this day are at this very moment lodged in the officers' mess of Royal Marine Barrett Stonehouse in Plymouth. The unit has been disbanded, but the regimental colours are in safekeeping in that officers' mess, and proudly flying from those colours is the streamer of the Presidential Unit Citation. Each one of us has a written Presidential Unit Citation, and we proudly wear the ribbon with a combat bronze star in it whenever we wear our medals with pride, as we will on Remembrance Sunday, when we remember not the glory of war, but our friends that we left behind.
Now, can we go ahead to the Antarctic? Because I think you were involved in some Falklands type trouble in the 50s.
Yes. In having returned to England and had leave, I was then drafted to a ship called HMS Superb, which was a large cruiser, and the commission was to the West Indies and a cruise around the West Indies and the Americas. This was a show-the-flag type cruise whereby you're in warm weather and you have quite a lot of hospitality cruises in different ports, Jamaica, Trinidad and so forth. This was going quite well until January, February 1953, when suddenly the ship steamed under radio silence south. And during the time we were steaming south, 28 of us were selected from the detachment. The Royal Marine Detachment was over 100 strong on this particular ship. 28 of us were selected, and on the 9th, 10th, 11th of February 1953, we rendezvoused with a small naval frigate just off the Falkland Islands. We were transferred onto this small naval frigate, and at the time we were under the orders direct from the Prime Minister, who was then Sir Winston Churchill. And our orders were to carry out a clandestine raid on a small island called Deception Island in the Antarctic, British Antarctica. Now, to give you a quick rundown on the situation, at that time, various parts of the Antarctic were being claimed by different countries. And during World War II, Germany had set up a few clandestine raider bases with which they raided the South Atlantic Fleet. And so in the latter part of World War II, Britain, having started to win the war, set up some more bases in the Antarctic. And these bases, which were set up originally by the Royal Navy to protect the bases and also to lay claim to the Antarctic Peninsula, were gradually reoccupied by what is known as the Falkland Island Dependencies Survey. They're known as FIDS, and their job at that time was to read the weather, to carry out various excavations and so forth, to generally find out what the value of Antarctica was in mineral as well as strategic and political values. And these various bases were dotted over the Antarctic. At the same time, Argentine and Chile had laid claim to the same areas of territory and had also set up bases in these various parts of the Antarctic. This is the situation in February 1953, when a base known as Base B on Deception Island was taken over by a group of Argentinians and Chileans. They were naval personnel. They imprisoned the small party of Falkland Island Dependencies Survey Team, who were British, in their hut, locked them in their hut, and pulled down the English flag, hoisted the Argentinian flag, and declared it Argentine territory. Now, this was a deliberate crime against one country to another, and this is why we had been selected to go down and literally rescue the vids. On our way down to the Deception Island, having left the Super, we were briefed on our task, which was to do a raid, recapture any Argentine, whatever, rescue the vids, and reclaim the territory as being British. My personal thoughts then was, here we go again. I've just come out of Korea and doing commando raids. I'm supposed to be on a warm weather cruise around the West Indies, having had the freezing cold of North Korea. And what did they do? They decided to send me all the way down to the Antarctic, which is I wasn't very pleased about. Nevertheless, the team which had been picked from the Superb contrived of several people like myself, who had been in 41 Independent Commando, and also members who had fought in the Malayan jungles of the Malayan campaign. So we were all pretty well experienced Royal Marines by this time, and well able to cope with the situation. Briefly, what happened? We did a dawn landing, even though it didn't get very dark down the Antarctic because of that particular time of the year. Nevertheless, we did a dawn landing. It was successful. We arrested several Argentinians. There's another big military base which the Argentinians had about 2 miles away, where the remainder of the Argentinian forces were, and we fortunately caught them on the hop when there was just a small number occupying the actual huts that they'd erected. We rescued the FIDS personnel from their hut. We then hoisted the British flag quite proudly, as has been done on other occasions, and off went the ship with the prisoners to deport them back to Argentina.
Did they resist?
No, there was no resistance. And with us, as a matter of interest, were a chief of police from the Falkland Islands. I believe there was 2 other policemen. And at the time, it was declared a civilian incident. Now, this happened in 1953. And at the time, we were warned that the operation we were carrying out came under the Official Secrets Act, part of which is known as the 30-year rule, which literally means you are not to speak about this to anyone without authorization for the next 30 years. Well, this 30-year rule was extended because of the Falklands War, and it is only recently that it's come to my knowledge, purely by us wishing to find out exactly what the situation is, that the records were released in late 1985 and 1986 to the Public Records Office. And I personally have been to the Public Records Office to study some of the